Christian greetings to each one. What a privilege to be here this morning, and I was impressed that we can look again at an Old Testament temple building and draw so many practical challenges for us today in New Testament church building. Enjoyed the discussion. In 2 weeks, the Lord willing, I am planning to be at Loyola for an all-day meeting there, and I have 3 assignments, and I chose to share the Sunday morning assignment for there, share that here this morning, and you can feel free to give some thoughts if there's something I should add or change. Before I go there, I'd appreciate feedback. The theme for that day of meetings there is practical Christian discipleship. Practical Christian discipleship, or we could just simply say I've been assigned to go to Loyola and preach 3 messages describing the everyday life of Christ's disciples. In North America, in the culture that we've grown up in and that we are familiar with, disciple is a word that's basically only ever used in Christian circles, in Christian context, isn't it? We don't hear of a lawyer's firm somewhere and they have 3 or 4 disciples of a great lawyer learning and following. We hear the word intern in the medical education process. We hear the word intern. We hear the word apprentice every once in a great while, but not very often. But disciple, only as it has to do with Christian context. But in the New Testament, in the first 5 books of the New Testament, the 4 Gospels and the book of Acts, within those 5 books, the word disciple is used over 250 times. So anyone that has any knowledge of the New Testament is familiar with that word at least. But do we understand it in the context of Jewish culture in that time and that day and the culture of that? And maybe we do. I learned quite a bit in studying this, and I intend to approach these assignments by first of all looking at the life of a disciple in Jesus' day in that culture, some of the details, and help us to get a better picture of what would have instantly been in the mind. Think of that little boy that shared his lunch with Jesus that day. I think if someone would have said the word disciple to him, he would have known instantly what it was. But we don't really. We don't know a lot about them. Just like if I say the word bishop, most of our school children for sure, instantly we know what a bishop is in the church. We might get a picture in our mind of a bishop officiating in a marriage. We might get a picture in our mind of a bishop in a baptism service or communion. And we just know. We know what a bishop does. We know who. But if that little boy would, if we could have taken the word bishop to him, the little boy that shared the lunch, in his culture, they didn't know what that was. And he'd have to come study what is a bishop in North America, just like we need to study a bit to understand what is a disciple in Jesus' day. So I want to spend a short time discussing Jewish disciples and some aspects of their lives. And I've tried to divide some of that into how they could pertain to the 3 different assignments that I've been given to help us to become better everyday disciples of Jesus. And by looking at this somewhat foreign concept of discipleship, the first message under this theme of practical Christian discipleship is the one for this morning, discipleship in speech. Let's look a little bit at disciples of Jesus' day. Jewish boys of Jesus' time would go to school typically from ages 5 to 12. Their schooling was mostly memory work. They spent most of their time memorizing, especially the first five books of the Old Testament, the books of Moses. And I don't know if you've read through them recently, but I've tried to imagine memorizing those books. It would be quite a task, but that's what they did. But after school age, young teenage boys would begin to learn a trade. Some of them became carpenters, farmers, fishermen, and they would start learning. But some, after they finished their school days, they were observed by rabbis. And we're going to use three words this morning through the message that mean basically the same thing: rabbi, master, and teacher. But these rabbis would observe, and they would pick out the ones that were the most apt to learn, maybe, or that had an extra interest in learning and were more teachable, maybe. And a rabbi would choose and ask that 13, 14 teenager, ask that boy to come and follow him. It was an honor to be chosen by a rabbi to follow. And we see Jesus taking that place as a rabbi. We're not going to turn to it. I think we all know the account very well in Mark 1. Jesus came preaching into Galilee, it says, and he came upon those boys fishing with their dad, Zebedee, and he said, "Come, follow me." And they left everything and they went and followed this rabbi. And that was very common in those days. The boys would be chosen and by a rabbi to come and follow and learn. I don't know that we can actually know. I'll admit to you, I've always pictured Jesus' disciples as maybe men in more his age, in their 30s. But in their culture, it would not be at all abnormal for these disciples of Jesus to have been teenagers. Now, the one that was a tax collector, I'd like to think he was older, but we don't know. But these young men followed a rabbi, and the years of following this rabbi were intense observation and learning about their master, about their teacher. Rabbi was the most honorable name, and often the students would often call him master or rabbi. And rabbi was a term of honor. In American schools, teachers have a huge influence on their students. I thought about that a bit. I've observed that a bit. I remember years ago, I think I was a teenager, when a visiting, it was an all-day meeting, and there was a visitor there asked to come in and lead the singing that day, the three services. I don't remember who he was, but I remember that he had a peculiar, or not, something about the way he led singing was not, it caught our attention. And I don't remember who the other man was that was there, but he told me after the one service, he said, "It's not hard to see that our song leader was a student of," and again, I don't remember the name, but somebody down in Pennsylvania. "You can tell by the way he leads singing that he was, his teacher must have been," and he gave a name. And I didn't know the man, so I couldn't have known. Yes, young men are impressionable. And there are things that we've learned from our teachers that we've carried with us. That's a fact. But disciples in Jesus' day observed very closely everything their master did. They wanted to imitate him. Turn to Luke chapter 6. We get a little bit of a description of this. Masters, teachers, and disciples spent a lot of time discussing the scripture. Not all of them, but some rabbis, some teachers would take their group of boys and they would travel from village to village and they would set up in a public place and others from the village would come and they would have scriptural discussions. And these disciples would watch so closely every word their master said. They wanted to understand. And we're going to look at some more of that in the next message. I hope to, through the fall here, bring the other two messages that I'm assigned, and if you're curious what they are, you can look in the witness that's in your mailboxes and you can see what the rest of the assignments are. Luke chapter 6 and verse 40. Jesus said, "The disciple is not above his master, but everyone that is perfect shall be as his master." Everyone that is perfect, or in the, we could say that is fully trained. Every disciple that is a successful disciple will be like his master, will be as his master. Just being a disciple was very strongly an imitation process. They learned to imitate their master. They watched very closely. He would watch him in business. They would observe how their master did business. They would observe him and his family relations. They would specifically observe and try to understand his thought processes and why he's thinking the way and why he does what he does. And that's an important thought to remember as we go through this message. A perfect disciple will be like his master. Not only memorizing the words he would say, but to grasp and adopt the thought processes and the convictions and the beliefs of the teacher, and then imitate him from the inside out. Let's go more into the message, practical Christian discipleship and speech. The first point I've titled, Jesus, our Rabbi. You can turn to John chapter 1. I'd like to read a few verses here. I have 2 points under this main point, and they both come from John chapter 1. John chapter 1 can be a bit confusing, but it really helps us to understand if we know that the Word, look in verse 14, and the Word was made flesh, that we could just as simply say, and Jesus was made flesh. Let's read verse 14 to 17. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bare witness of him and cried, saying, "This was he of whom I spake. He that cometh after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. And of his fullness have all we received, and grace for grace. For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ." Who is our Rabbi? Who is our master? What is at the core of him? What do we know about the words he spoke? And why did he do it? If we're going to be disciples of him, we need to be just like those Jewish boys, and we need to understand from the inside out what made Jesus, what makes our master talk the way he talked. We have the words grace and truth here 2 times, and I'd like to just focus on them a bit. The reason I like to focus on them is because I found 2 descriptions of how people felt when Jesus talked in the Gospels that I'd like to look at a bit. And they relate directly to these words that he was full of grace and truth. Turn to Matthew chapter 7. I'd like to read two verses in Matthew chapter 7. These verses, the last two verses of chapter 7 here, describe the response and the reaction of the audience after they just heard the greatest sermon ever preached by the greatest teacher that ever taught. And it tells us what they said in verse 28, Matthew 7, 28. And it came to pass when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. I suggest that the reason Jesus had a notable tone and a way of speaking of authority was because Jesus is the truth. He didn't just speak the truth. He said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the truth. And so Jesus was full of grace and truth. Jesus is truth, the Bible tells us. And he spoke with authority because he is the truth. And we're going to look at this some more as we in the next point. But I'd like to make this statement as well. The final proof, the final vindication of this truth, that he is truth, is the fact that all men will be judged by his word. And that is the test of truth. Men's destinies will be determined by his word, and that's truth. We also had that in John chapter 1, the thought of grace, and that's the second part of I'd like to look at briefly here about our rabbi, our master, full of grace and truth. I have a Power Bible on my laptop, and I looked up this verse, and it gives me the option of reading it in about a dozen translations, that verse from John chapter 1. And most of them translated this into the word grace and truth, but one translation, and I don't remember which, it doesn't really matter, one translated this word grace as the word favor, and one translated it as the word love. And I think that helps us to understand grace, favor, and love. Or maybe we'd say favor produced by love. Grace. Not something that's earned, but unmerited favor because of love. That's my master. He's full of grace. He's full of love and favor. He is grace and truth. These words, the words grace and truth, we grapple and we try to use other words and we try to understand the whole scope of these words. But Jesus, our rabbi, is not confined by the constraints of words and human minds. He's not confined by the ability of human minds to grasp it. He is grace. He is love. And these words are just the best we can do to put a description to it. I'd like to look at one verse in relation to this in Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4 and verse 22. This also describes how people felt after hearing Jesus. Luke 4, 22, and all bear him witness and wondered at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And I looked it up. What does gracious? And it's exactly the same root word as grace in John chapter 1. This grace that is Jesus, that what he is, spilled out into his words, didn't it? And they marveled at the gracious words. From the inside out, an expression of who Jesus is. And this is important because the only way, the only possible way for any of us here to be a perfect disciple, fully trained, recognized by speech, by our speech as a disciple of Jesus, the only way is we must experience His grace and we must embrace Him as truth and love it. And it needs to be expressed from the inside out. Not a mimicking, not a face, a fake front, but genuine words that come from the inside out as a result of having experienced His grace and embracing Him as truth. And also, more importantly, that is the only way to meet the approval of our Master. Any other valiant attempt at imitating the speech of our rabbi will come up empty. Check 1 Corinthians 13. But we need to experience and we need to be moved by His love, by charity and grace. I'd like to now go to the second part of the message, and I've titled this Commands and Warnings from Our Master, from Our Teacher. What did your teacher say that will guide and determine what you'll say is the question I'd like to look at. And we're going to look at, I think I have 3 points under this. The first one, we'll turn to Matthew chapter 5. What did Jesus say that will change and guide what I say? Matthew 5, let's start reading at verse 33. Matthew 5:33. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is His footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. Number one, what did Jesus say that will guide what I say? Speak the truth. Swear not at all. The two are linked together, I believe. Looking at how He said it, we see that connection. Very, very clear, very simple, and it's repeated again in the book of James, swear not at all. It's very common in courts and in official business in our nation here to lay one's hand on a Bible and swear to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, and I think it usually ends with the words, so help me God. Jesus answers the question very clearly. Swear not at all. Don't swear by the Bible. Don't swear by heaven. Don't swear. Tell the truth. God's people used oaths in the Old Testament. Yes, we can find that. But Jesus clearly shows us a change. But I say unto you. So there may be those that you will hear reasoning that an oath is fine because it was done in the Old Testament by God's people. Jesus shows that change here. Swear not. Swear not. If our speech is to imitate our rabbi, we need to start just like the boys in Jesus' day did, and start by filling our minds with the truth and studying and knowing the Word. That's the basis for telling the truth, for speaking the truth, is being guided by the truth. That's the only way to be perfect like our Master. There's something in every one of us that wants our words to have authority. I think I speak for everyone here. We want people to believe us. We want our words to influence others. That's natural. But think with me how many extra words are used today to accomplish this. to add weight to what's being said. Words that are used simply to add emphasis. Words and phrases that are intended to make the listeners believe it more. And I thought of throwing out a few examples, but I don't know if I will. But we're not just exactly free of this, are we? As sure as I stand here, how does that fit into let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, and whatever more is of evil? Isn't that what Jesus said? That's what my rabbi said. And I don't think we ever find Jesus needing to do that. He spoke with one as authority because what he said was truth and nothing but the truth. Let's imitate our rabbi, speak the truth, and let's allow truth to be its own authority rather than feeling a human need to add emphasis to what we say. Let your yea be yea. Let's turn to Colossians 3 and read two verses. Colossians chapter 3, let's read verses 9 and 10. Lie not one to another, seeing that ye have put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. I'd like to just highlight for us a reminder of a simple, simple truth, that there's lying and dishonesty is part of the old nature. It is part of the lives of those who are not following the Master. Anyone who has experienced and embraced the truth, the way, the truth, and the life, anyone who has embraced Jesus Christ and is following him has put off these deeds. We didn't read verse 8, but there's more listed there. And dishonesty. And we have the direction, I believe it's in Romans, isn't it? Provide things honest in the sight of all men. And so we have the command from our Master that would guide how we talk. Speak the truth. Do not swear. Matthew chapter 12. The next two points come from Matthew chapter 12. What did Jesus, our Master, say that would guide our speech? I'd like to read Matthew chapter 12, two verses for this point, verses 34 and 35. 12:34, O generation of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. A good man out of the good treasure of the heart bringeth forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure bringeth forth evil things. Point number two, under what did our Master say that will guide how we speak? Your speech reveals your character. The stream declares the character of the fountain. We have James. I'll just read. You don't need to turn to it. I think we know these verses very well, but I'll read from James chapter 3. For the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Doth a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? The stream, what comes out declares what's at the source. Jesus said, what your mouth says proves what's in your heart. Jesus was responding to the hateful, jealous accusations that the Pharisees made here in Matthew 12, verse 24. They said, this fellow doth not cast out devils, but by Beelzebub, the prince of devils. They made a very heavy accusation against Jesus. And he responded, and that's what he said, generation of vipers. If you're speaking evil, you are evil. And so it is in our lives, just as much as in the Pharisees. What we hate and what we love is clearly expressed by our speech, isn't it? And I have some questions for each of us to answer before ourselves and God. Do you love truth and positive things, or do you love juicy stories and gossip? What does the stream tell of the fountain? What does your speech tell of your heart? Do you love God or the things of the world? Is your heart spiritual or carnal? Listen to yourself talk. What does your speech tell of your heart? Do you love God or mammon? Do you love the church or money? Is it all right if we draw some conclusions from what we hear you say? Do you hate your brother? Is it fair if I come and challenge you when I hear repeated negative stories? If by your words it's clear that a certain person could never do anything right? If by your words everything he or she does will be talked about in a negative context and the worst will be assumed? Does Jesus, our Master, not have the same thing to say to us as he did to the hateful Pharisees? An evil man out of the evil treasure bringeth forth evil things. Do you love your family, the ones you live and work with every day? Do Jesus' words apply here? If your conversations at home this past week were recorded and played back to you, would you unashamedly claim to be nearing perfection and imitating your master and teacher from the inside out, like a true disciple? These questions become very sobering as we move to the next point of what our master said that will guide what we say. Let's pick up reading in Matthew chapter 12, verse 36. But I say unto you, that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. Point number three. By the record of your words, you will pass or fail the final test while you face your master. We can understand that evil words show an evil heart. That logic is something we can understand. And Jesus says to the Pharisees that evil words prove an evil heart. But I say unto you, and he takes it to another level, and he says not only evil words, but idle words. And I looked it up. This word idle is used another time in the Gospels. I didn't record, I don't remember where. But it talks about men who were standing idle in the marketplace. Same exact word. They were accomplishing nothing. They were of no value. And how many of our words fit this category, accomplishing nothing and of no value? No, they're not evil. But Jesus says that we will give account of even those words. The words we say are recorded, and we will answer for them, and we will, by our words, be justified or condemned while standing before our Master. I have a very short point, the last point of the message, and I just called it gracious words. And I'd like to end on a positive and on a call to imitate the gracious words of our teacher, of our rabbi. There's a verse in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 that says, "The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, loving, favorable." That's the words of a wise man. I'd like to call us and challenge us that the best way to have gracious words is to talk more about our rabbi and what we're learning from him, our master who is full of grace and truth. And there's some really tough times in we face challenges to be gracious in our words. And I'd like to read Galatians 4, chapter 6. At first I thought this is the verse I would base this point on, but I looked at the context of Galatians 4, 6. I'm sorry, it's Colossians 4, 6. Colossians 4, 6, "Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that ye may know how ye ought to answer every man." But as I looked at the context of this verse, back up to verse 5, "Walk in wisdom toward them that are without, redeeming the time." The context of this is facing opposition. And we looked at that in our Sunday school lesson. And there are times when we face opposition, and there is opposition to the Christian, to the disciples. And then, when we face opposition, when we're falsely accused, "Let your speech be always with grace to them that are without, and certainly to them that are within, let your speech be with grace, that ye may know how ye ought to answer every man." And there again, the best answer is to have gracious words, is to focus on grace and truth and on our teacher. What is Jesus that he's grace and truth to the core, we'd say, and that's the expression that comes from him. And so we need to constantly be filling ourselves with grace and truth, with the words of Jesus. That's the only way that the right words will come out. That's the only way we'll face tough situations where hot words are our first response. But we need to learn and discipline ourselves as disciples to think and to process things like our master, like our rabbi, and express it because we've disciplined ourselves and because he is filling us. And then love and grace and truth come out and proceed in our speech. Let's kneel to pray.